is Originally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte.
There are questions that oftentimes come up when you get involved in visiting a doctor or being helped by a nurse or some other medical staff member as to if they really understand the human side of healthcare. And in particular, there's an opportunity that if attending classes at Indiana University Northwest in Gary, you can try for a medical humanities minor. And to talk more about it, we have a couple people that are most involved in that. Dr. Crystal Shannon, she's an assistant professor at the School of Nursing at IU Northwest, and we have one of the participants with a new online course involved in the medical humanities minor, Professor Jonathan Briggs. Actually, he's a history professor, but he follows in some very interesting areas. And thanks for being with us on Regionally Speaking today.
Thank you for having us, Chris.
Well, Professor Shannon, if you will start us out and explain in general terms what the idea behind the medical humanities minor is all about.
Essentially, especially when it comes in the play of healthcare, we want to ensure that healthcare providers remember that a patient's experience comes with them to the clinical setting. Once they enter the healthcare environment, be it a physician's office, an outpatient clinic, the inpatient setting, or a hospital environment, they bring all of those experiences and expectations with them. And it helps to guide them throughout their experience with us, but it also may help to impact how they experience healthcare with the providers. One thing that we hope that our students will gain from continuing their exploration into the medical humanities is the understanding of that patient's background and their story about their own lived experiences and how it's influenced how they seek health care.
Who thought up the idea of creating this medical humanities minor?
I developed it, Chris, kind of out of my own experiences of moving into a new field of research, which was I'm working up on a project right now about the history of autism. When I started to engage new scholars, I began to realize that a number of them were coming from other fields, philosophy, anthropology, sociology, but that there was a kind of shared experience among them, which was that much of their research engaged with the practice of medicine, and that there was a value in this engagement. And this was known as medical humanities, and it was happening in a number of institutions across the country. And so in talking with these kind of new colleagues of mine, I began to realize, well, this would have a value as well at my institution. And so I looked within the institution for resources to develop this, found some colleagues whose work could be fit into this idea. And, lo and behold, here we are a few years later, we're launching the ship here as well.
What type of topics can this particular minor cover when you put that into the big interdisciplinary program that's called a medical humanities minor?
Well, being a participant myself, it involves history, but we also offer courses on anthropology, on literature, in communications, and then as well as philosophy, particularly with ethics in medicine, which is something that really was also a kernel in this, in that there was already this ethical component required for the sort of medical practices within the institution. So I was able to kind of germinate out of that to develop this program. And where I'm hoping to go with it as well is to do things as well like creative aspects. So in a number of conferences that I've been involved in with the medical humanities, one of the things that I've seen that I think would be very beneficial is that medical doctors also come to these and present their works, things like films or painting, poetry, where they're looking at the patient experience using, say, the fine arts. So I'm hoping to develop that as well here and finding allies within, say, the fine arts or within creative writing that we could integrate into this program as well. So how I'm envisioning it is kind of open-ended where, we could allow students in this to explore through a number of different ways.
Now, we know, Professor Briggs, that your new online course called The History of Disability is one of the five courses that's going to be in the curriculum that IU Northwest has set up for this new medical humanities minors this fall. What, besides your particular work that you were doing on the history of autism in France, what else led you to come up with the curriculum for this particular course?
Well, I mean, certainly part of it is rooted in my own experiences. My son is on the autism spectrum, so I began to get kind of involved with a number of organizations that work with not only autistic children, but more importantly, autistic adults. And so I began to think about, well, my own assumptions, I suppose you could say, about disability and about, the rights of the disabled. And I realized, oh, well, there is a whole corpus of works on this. And, you know, I think that this is an important thing to kind of communicate to students, especially students who have a tendency to work with these kinds of populations. So so it led me to think about, well, not just kind of mental disability, but also physical disability, and what are the similarities and differences between them. And so I thought this would be worthwhile in teaching a whole course. I ran a pilot of it about 2 years ago and got some really great feedback from the students in this pilot, and it helped me to build the course as it is now, in which we start with around the 18th century and the Enlightenment, and begin to think about how Western society has framed disability in various ways, and how even the notion of disability has changed since then, where something that might be disabling at one point, one of the case studies they used about glaucoma in the 18th century, now this is a kind of treatable condition, and so no longer is glaucoma necessarily considered to be blindness where it was before.
Mm-hmm. One of the things I know that you mentioned in some of the information and kind of setting things up for this particular course that you have available is talking about why we seem to find more staircases in newly constructed buildings, maybe instead of ramps. And it looks like that sometimes the only times you ever see ramps are ones that have to be put in because they have to meet the Americans with Disabilities Act requirements.
Absolutely. And, of course, that is a bill that is, you know, always kind of under threat. You know, usually there are groups who see it as, you know, an onerous challenge to make sure to accommodate as many populations as they can, and yet, you know, it is the law of the land at this point. So it's one of those things where we don't always conceive of how all populations would interact with a space. And in fact, the building that I'm talking to you from is our new arts and sciences building, which itself, you know, it has, say, one elevator to accommodate, you know, the entirety of the building. And, you know, I understand there are costs and things like this, but it does kind of speak to the assumptions that still lay in the way that we think about how we construct our own environments. And the assumption is that everybody walks, which is not really a fair assumption, and I think that getting people to engage with those assumptions is an important part of, it's at the root of this class.
One of the things I note in traveling around the communities, I noted in particular there's one hospital here in Northwest Indiana that has managed, because of course the ADA requirements make it easy for people in wheelchairs to get around, they have managed to make it from one of their entrances off a parking lot to be able to do a series of ramps with a small turnaround. So you go from the level that's the ground level down to a little lower level, which is where you get access to the elevators. And this way you still come off that ramp system, I guess you could call it, and you're right there by the elevator. So it's very convenient. They planned it out very well, and I'm sure it's been in there for quite some time. It's very interesting. You mentioned in some of the information that you've experienced in your life about having to take advantage of academic workshops, and there was one in particular that you wanted to attend, but you couldn't because of some extenuating circumstances, I understand, involving your son. Tell us about what this particular workshop is all about and what kind of problems that you've run into that maybe might get covered in this idea of medical humanities.
So the workshop was run through the National Endowment of Humanities, and I was one of the national participants in what was known as the Global History of Disability. Mm-hmm. And it was to bring together scholars from all across the country, and we were working workshops to develop new curriculum in history of disability, to kind of share ideas and to move forward together in working in our own research on disability. So I was very excited to get the invitation, very honored. But as the workshop loomed closer, I began to realize there were some issues with clearing insurance for my son, because he receives a lot of applied behavioral analysis therapy as part of his treatment for autism, really, mm-hmm. to kind of help him to move through the world itself. So not being able to guarantee the proper amount of ABA through the insurance company, because I would be moving temporarily providers to a new location, I realized that if I couldn't get that guarantee, it would not be in the best interest of my son.
Yeah.
And so without being able to accommodate my son, I had to turn it down. And, you know, they were very gracious about it. And luckily they were able to find a replacement so that the workshop could continue. And they shared as much information with me as they could about what was happening. There are some rules about people being able to participate remotely that meant that I couldn't directly participate, but I'm still affiliated with it. And so that's very nice. In somewhat of a disappointment, of course, but it also, I got the materials which allowed me to integrate a number of them into this disability course that I'll be teaching this fall. So that was great. But it kind of talks again about kind of the challenges about something we may not even think about, which is, you know, there's no national healthcare law about what insurance companies are supposed to cover. This is something that is rolled back to the states. Interestingly enough, Indiana is a very progressive state when it comes to the treatment of autism, but not all states fall under that same category. And so my son, who actually lives in Florida, he gets different treatment depending on where we go. And when he comes up with me, sometimes it's much easier to get this treatment, where in other cases it's a much more uphill battle. And so even in these like things that we might assume there are little challenges in, like, say, you know, the insurance industry. It's actually, there are all these challenges that face people at all levels. And so I think again, it's an interesting conversation to have. Like, what are the assumptions about, say, like, health that we talk about when, you know, because disability and health are these kind of two poles that we constantly might move between. You know, what are the assumptions about where those boundaries lay? And I think that's one of the things that my own experiences kind of feed into.
Now, Professor Crystal Shannon, being involved in this from the School of Nursing perspective, are you looking forward with great anticipation to what some of the courses and the other work that's going to happen as this new curriculum gets going?
Absolutely. You know, conventionally, nursing has always been looked at as the caring profession, and it's something that we take great pride in, because our main focus is to look at the patient from a holistic nature and from a holistic perspective. However, it can be very difficult and cumbersome when you really do get bogged down with a lot of the tasks that are involved in the clinical care process. But we don't want to lose sight of the patient as a person, and that's where that humanistic component comes into play. And I really do believe that our students, by participating in these types of courses, will, as they gain their clinical skills, they won't forget the true nature of nursing, which is that caring perspective.
Now, again, ready for this particular curriculum to begin here this fall semester, have you had a chance to talk with some students that you've experienced in some of your other courses before then as to whether they're looking forward to maybe signing up for some of these courses?
I actually have. I've talked to them very frequently about them as they're looking for electives and they're thinking about minors, for them to strongly consider this as an adjunctive minor to a profession that really promotes the encouragement and the connection to patient care. And I do believe that by participation in it, it will just give them a wealth of experience, a wealth of foundational background that they will be able to take with them into the clinical care environment.
Now, if anyone is interested, any students or family members have students at IU Northwest interested in finding out more about the Medical Humanities Program, how can they find out more now?
Well, there is, of course, a website within the institution that gives them all the information they would need. They can certainly contact me. As the kind of shadow director of all of this at this point. By email is the best way these days. And so my email is jwbriggs@iun.edu, and that's a great way of, if nothing else, just kind of open the contact, and I can kind of tell them more about what they can expect in these kinds of in this program and in these kinds of courses.
That's Professor Jonathan Briggs. He is primarily a professor of history, but he's very much involved in one of the new online courses here, involved in this medical humanities program that is underway at IU Northwest, along with Dr. Crystal Shannon. She's an assistant professor of the School of Nursing. And thank you very much, for both of you, for being with us to talk about this. And we hope that a lot more students and potential students are very interested in this. We'll get signed up and look into these courses that IU Northwest is going to offer.
Thanks so much, Chris.
Thank you.
Appreciate the time.
You're listening to Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Radio. An increasing number of Indiana school districts are turning to truancy courts to try to address the issues with chronic absenteeism. Porter County officials approved a measure earlier this month that will allow the Portage Township schools to move forward with plans for such a program. But as we hear from Indiana Public Broadcasting's Barbara Brozier, as she reports from Northwest Indiana, the focus is not on punishing students.
As students walk through the halls of Merrillville High School, they're carrying more than just backpacks. Between meeting graduation requirements and taking multiple state tests, they're shouldering a lot of pressure.
I look at what kids are expected to do today compared to when I was their age, and the expectations are so different.
That's Danny Lackey, Director of Diversity in Student Support Services for Merrillville Schools. He says those heightened expectations make showing up to class especially important. But the district noticed some students consistently weren't.
And as the years go by, what we expect from students in terms of their education continues to climb. So when they are absent or tardy, and when those tardies add up, that's a significant amount of instruction that they don't get.
A 2012 study found that students who miss 10 or more days of school perform at lower levels on the state's standardized exam, the I-STEP. So the district started what's called a truancy court to try and address the issue. When a student racks up 3 unexcused absences, a letter goes home to the family, letting them know the school district is concerned and they could receive an ordinance violation if it continues. When a student racks up 9 unexcused absences, they get a ticket that refers the family to Judge Gina Jones's truancy court.
When they come see me, we have an option of whether they can either do community service and pay a fine and cost, or we kind of look deeper into the family to see if there's something that we could do to help them, whether it is tutoring or whether there's some parenting skills that need to be taught.
The idea behind the court isn't to discipline children for not showing up, but to figure out what's causing the behavior and how the school district can help. There are cases where Jones does refer kids to a juvenile detention center, but she says that's rare.
I wanted to be that layer in between the school and the juvenile justice system, because I think a lot of times these cases can tend to go a little bit faster and further where the child ends up in the juvenile justice system.
The court is in its third year, and Jones says she sees at least 30 truancy cases a month. Another nearby school district plans to implement a similar program during the upcoming school year. The attendance rate at Portage Township schools fluctuates between 93% and 96%, which is in line with the state average. While Superintendent Amanda Alanez says that indicates truancy isn't a significant problem, it still needs to be addressed.
Whether we've got a truancy issue for a specific family or a truancy here or there, for us, it is a big deal regardless.
The school district already does some outreach with families when there are issues with absences. But Alanez says she hopes establishing a court will increase the district's options and formalize the process. She says oftentimes kids aren't just skipping school because they don't want to go.
There are root causes that we're finding. For instance, students who do not have an alarm clock. So they have purchased alarm clocks for students.
The truancy court is a partnership between the district, city, and county. The city council passed a chronic absenteeism ordinance earlier this year that, among other things, gives local police the power to pick up students and take them to school if they aren't there.
We're looking at how we provide resources and how we combine those resources between the city, the schools, and the township to make sure that we can pool just a myriad of different opportunities for families to grow strong families for the entire community and make sure that our kids get their education.
Portage leaders are hopeful the court will make a difference. Merrillville school leaders say it's worked for them. But Lackey says he wants to have at least 5 years of data before determining just how much of an impact the courts had.
I believe that when children know that you care, when they know that your community care, and that they're going to hold you accountable, and they're also going to provide you with support and let you know when you do well, then that's the best environment that we can provide for a kid.
Data from the state's Department of Education shows the attendance rate at Merrillville schools is slightly higher than the state average. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Barbara Brozier.
Metal detectors are just one of several steps that the state and schools are taking to keep youngsters safe. But as the Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jeannie Lindsay reports, there is another essential piece in the puzzle. How can teachers prevent or better prepare for these worst-case scenarios?
A week before school started in Brown County, class was already in session for this group of educators, law enforcement, and mental health professionals.
Talk about why they're increasing in frequency, the location, and why there's a skewed number of people killed and wounded.
Today's lesson focuses on what to do, like run, hide, or fight, in case of a hostile aggressor, like an active shooter.
That's going to, if the door's locked and it's dark, that the shooter is going to maybe pass our room, and that they're the safest that way.
Kirk Reitzman teaches at Brown County High School. He's describing the intruder training he's received before. In all three districts he's taught in, it's mostly focused on only one of the three parts, the lockdown.
And so we have to be the ones that are protecting the students, and we have to take those measures. And quite honestly, just sitting there and kind of waiting for somebody to come in is not enough to protect them.
So teachers and administrators say more thorough training with the run, hide, fight strategies gives them tools to better protect themselves and their students. It's actually the same type of training used in Noblesville schools, where teacher Jason Seaman tackled a shooter as the student opened fire in his classroom earlier this year. No one died, and the shooter injured only two people, including Seaman.
I want to make it clear that my actions on that day, in my mind, were the only acceptable actions I could have done given the circumstances. I deeply care for my students and their well-being.
It's a hard truth for some to consider the possibility of taking similar actions in their classrooms, but elementary school principal Kelly Bruner says everyone agrees on the bottom line.
It is nerve-wracking to think about that happening, but our number one priority is the safety of the students.
School shootings have spurred a lot of talk about safety this year, mostly to harden up schools. The state has made more money available for schools to amp up security. Some schools have even made moves to offer certain staff access to guns. But educators and other officials have also stressed the importance of another, softer side of safety. In an interview earlier this year, State Superintendent of Public Instruction, Jennifer McCormick, said mental and behavioral health remains a key part of the conversation.
That whole piece, the whole child well-being piece, we're looking at our systems of care in Indiana. Not all counties are where we need to be, so we're looking at gaps.
Future teachers want to close those gaps, too. Dan Melnick at IU's School of Education says student voice drives professional development events, and students want to focus on what can make them a great teacher and make their schools safer, building relationships.
They understand there is a need for school safety. It's not that they don't feel unsafe right now. It's more that they want to know how to better a school, how to better a situation when they get there.
So as schools lock more doors to keep people safe, educators hope to open others for the same reason. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jeannie Lindsay.
This is Originally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Purdue University Northwest in Hammond, as well as in Westville, getting ready for another semester and another year of classes. And they're doing a lot of it on campus these days, at least through this week, the first official week of school, with food fun giveaways and food music giveaways and fun. This is the way I should read exactly the way that it's put in the information. We're talking about Fall Welcome Week, and with us to talk about that and some other important things happening this week on the Purdue Northwest campus, we have the Director of Strategic Marketing and Communications, Doug Clark, with us. Doug, thanks for joining us here on Regionally Speaking today.
Well, thanks for the invitation, Chris. I appreciate being here.
Let's start here first with the food fun and all. It's an opportunity more for the new students as well as the returning students to both campuses to get acclimated to life on the Purdue University campus up here in Northwest Indiana, isn't it?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I mean, we want our students not only to be engaged in the academic experience, but we want them to be connected with our campus community and be a part of our community. So having these kinds of events during the first week of classes helps students to recognize what opportunities are available for other types of enrichment activities.
Now, we know that the most of the activities are going to be over the next 4 days, including today, the 20th. And they will continue on towards the end of the week. And they also kind of dovetail, at least here on the Hammond campus, they kind of dovetail with another important event that's happening. We'll talk about that in more detail in just a moment. Let's talk about the welcome rallies that are coming up here on Wednesday and Thursday on the campuses.
Yeah, we're really excited, and we're hoping, obviously, for great weather those 2 days.
Yes.
At the welcome rally events on Wednesday, the 22nd, from 11:30 to 1:30 on our Westville campus, that's when the Welcome Rally event is happening over there. And it's a way for our student groups and others within our institution to have more of a fair-like atmosphere to bring our new students and our returning students together. And that's going to be happening over in Westville. In Hammond, very similar type of event. That's happening on Thursday, August 23rd. So same time, and we're excited.
Are these just primarily opportunities for students to kind of relax a little bit before they really jump into the serious work of taking their courses and living on campus, and maybe for some, the very first time they maybe have been away from home for any length of time?
Yeah, it's not only it's just to kind of help students acclimate to what college campus is like. So it's bringing those students together to see the student organizations that are out there and available for them to participate in, other leadership opportunities that they may have, and what kind of interests they might have. It's really bringing that community together and getting our students to find other opportunities that creates a full and enriching college experience.
What types of organizations have a chance to offer services and experiences for students aside from the usual time they spend in the classroom? What type of student organizations are out there? I mean, just mention a few that you're aware of.
Yeah, there's a number of different organizations, ones that are connected with some of the academic programs, whether that's in our like broadcasting type of programs, but also our Student Government Association is going to be participating and helping to bring students into that representation process so they can feel a part of that campus community. But I'm actually going to be excited because for me, this is also my first welcome rally at Purdue Northwest.
That's right.
I'm excited to see what's all out there as well.
I know that one of the important and very active organizations on the Hammond and the Westville campuses, although they're kind of based at the Hammond campus, is the one that helps veterans not only get acclimated to life away from the military after they get out of service, but also for some of them, the first time they've been back to college or maybe their first time in college to begin with.
Yeah, I mean, definitely. We're very proud as Purdue University Northwest to be a veteran serving institution. We definitely want to help our veterans to make that transition to college life, and we have a very extensive veterans program that helps do that.
When it's an opportunity to find out what life is like on the Purdue campus, whether it's Westville or in Hammond, you also get a chance to I guess, learn how the way around. For like I said, here it comes back to if you're a new student, the campus is compact enough, both campuses for that matter, compact enough that you can get around and figure out where you have to be and where you want to be. And it's not like they sent you down to West Lafayette. West Lafayette campus is sprawling, and it's quite a change, I imagine, if you've been down there to visit, I'm sure, mm-hmm. and what people around here have gone down to visit too. It's probably a little easier to navigate for many, especially first year students.
Yeah, we're an intimate environment here. I think that's one of the valuable assets that Purdue Northwest has. It's a campus that's very accessible to the students, but it provides a lot of the academic credibility of a big, large university. So we have really the best of both worlds.
We're talking with Doug Clark. He is the director of a strategic marketing and communications, get the title right, at Purdue University Northwest, and he's covering both the Hammond campus as well as the Westville campus. With all the activities going on the Hammond campus on Thursday, one of the other activities, aside from the welcome rallies and opportunities for students to get accustomed to their new surroundings, is a groundbreaking ceremony that's coming up during the day for a brand new building that is going to be built on the Hammond campus. Tell us more about the Bioscience Innovation Building, its importance to the Hammond campus, and what we're liable to see if we go over for the groundbreaking.
Oh, absolutely. Well, we are super excited at Purdue Northwest for this opportunity. We have it's a $40 million facility. The Bioscience Innovation Building is going to be housing our College of Nursing and our Biological Sciences Department. And, already the construction has already begun over the summer. So we have a fencing up already. And when it comes to the groundbreaking ceremony, it's really a way for us to celebrate with our community. We have been just very appreciative of our state representatives from the area who helped buoy support at the State House for getting the funding for this particular building. Purdue Northwest hasn't seen a building like this at least on our Hammond campus, being built since 1997. So the impact of this particular building is to really spark dynamic learning and in collaboration in the field of STEM in regards to the healthcare in mm-hmm. the region. I mean, healthcare is the number two economic driver for the Northwest Indiana region, and we really feel that this is going to create an impact for Purdue Northwest in that area.
Has it been a case here because of the importance of STEM, I guess all of the disciplines involved, the science, technology, engineering, and math, which is what STEM stands for, is that just an opportunity to see how the campus has grown and the demand for courses in the various schools at Purdue Northwest has come out?
Yeah, I think it not only recognizes that Purdue Northwest is recognizes our community and the needs of our community, and we're wanting to have an impact, but it also shows the value of Purdue Northwest and how we are an innovative institution, and we're getting that the level of support that's required to help us continue to be not only an innovation for the education that we provide our students, but also an innovator for having an impact in our community. We have a number of programs that we have done in collaboration, that work in collaboration with industry and businesses and organizations. We definitely take an outward focus as an institution, and this is one of the areas that we're hoping to have more of an impact on.
Now, when this new Bioscience Innovation Building is completed and it's occupied by students and faculty and staff, is it replacing or, I guess, auxiliary to any other building that's already on campus?
Yeah, we have we're going to be creating definitely state-of-the-art research labs, mm-hmm. And teaching labs. That's one of the values of this particular facility. It's a 68,000-square-foot facility. And right now our programs are housed in our in the GITE building, and we're expecting some of those programs, to, like I said, with nursing and biological sciences to be moved over into this particular building. With state-of-the-art equipment, with a dynamic learning environment, we're really expecting those programs to continue to foster innovation.
I guess the next question is, once you get the program started in the new building, what happens to the old? As you say, some of the courses from the School of Nursing is already being held in the GITE building, and I'm sure other courses there too. Are there any plans for the building when the new building takes over those classes?
Yeah, that's still under consideration. We're evaluating what the value of that facility will continue to be on our campus, and that will be we'll be making some more determinations in the future on that.
Now, we know that the fence is already up for the construction workers to come in and work where the site of the, for the new building is. But for somebody maybe who hasn't necessarily come to the Hammond campus, where is the new building going to be built, or is being built, I should say?
Yeah, it's if you're coming in from the 73rd Street entrance to our campus, it is between or in the area of Lashie Hall, which is one of our administrative buildings, and our Student Union Library building in the far end of our surface parking lot. So,
well, in fact, that's where the groundbreaking ceremony is going to be. I understand they're in the neighborhood of the Student Union Library building, on that end of campus there.
Yeah, it's on that end. It's really going to be more in the area around Lashie Hall.
Mm-hmm. If anybody would like to take a look at least the artist's conceptions of what this new Bioscience Innovation Building will hopefully look like, things can change. But where can somebody go if they'd like to take a look and see what the plans are for this building?
Oh, yeah, great. We have a website that I would definitely direct people to. It's pnw.edu/bioscience-innovation. That can show you artist renderings of what the building will look like, gives more details on what is going to be housed in that facility. And we actually have a live streaming camera that anybody can watch at any time to see the progress.
That's great. That's great. Doug Clark is the Director of Strategic Marketing and Communications for Purdue University Northwest, covering both the Hammond and the Westfield campuses. And we're talking, of course, about not only the groundbreaking on Thursday for the new Bioscience Innovation Building, but also the welcome rallies that are going to happen at both campuses here this week. And Doug, thank you for coming by and giving us the latest on this. And we hope folks, if they can't make it over and take a look, actually see the groundbreaking of the new building, they at least check out that webcam.
Absolutely.
Many economists predicted that President Donald Trump's trade war would harm U.S. farmers. It certainly has, but as Indiana Public Broadcasting Samantha Horton tells us, Hoosier farmers say they've been hurt twice by both soybean and steel tariffs.
Fifth-generation Elkhart County farmer Mike Morehouse comes from a family that's been working the land for more than 150 years. Recently, he bought a new grain bin to store his corn.
Well, the grain bin's 48-foot diameter, and it's 15 rings high. It holds 72,000 bushels of grain, which is 70 semi-loads, and it'll be used this fall for holding our corn harvest that's coming up.
The bin went up last month, but Morehouse made the purchase at the end of last year.
We talked to the people that we bought our grain bin from, and they said that the grain bin has went up $21,000 in purchase price if we wouldn't have bought this thing back in December.
Hostetler Grain Equipment sales representative Kevin Hirschberger has been selling farm equipment, including grain bins, for the past 28 years. He says several factors affect the price difference, including year-end discounts and last year's lower cost for steel. But he says President Trump's tariffs have caused prices to rise.
Pretty much across the line, there has been a price increase. Several different manufacturers have taken larger increases to the tune of 14-15%. Others are smaller. I think the smallest that I know of is 3.5%, so anywhere in between there.
Morehouse says if he'd had to pay the increased price, he'd have found other ways to store his excess corn instead.
We probably wouldn't have purchased it for a $21,000 increase. We would have figured out another way to harvest our grain and putting it in other places.
While the grain bins and other equipment are made of American steel, Purdue University agricultural economics professor Wally Tyner says when prices went up for foreign steel, it gave domestic manufacturers an excuse to raise their prices too.
Let's suppose that, you're a steel or aluminum producer and your price is 100 and your competitor's price is 100. Then your competitor gets a 25% tariff, so their price is now 125. Are you going to leave your price at 100? No, you're going to increase your price close to, maybe a little below, what your competitor's is.
Hirschberger says that artificial price jump has impacted his company's sales.
We have noticed people not being quite as quick to make a purchase decision, thinking about it longer.
Tyner says the rise in farm equipment prices coupled with the decline of crop sale prices is a double whammy for farmers' bottom lines.
Farm incomes were already low, and now they're getting squeezed on both ends. They're getting squeezed on the output price going down and the input prices going up.
Corn and soybean farmer Mike Morehouse says he supports the president's trade disputes, but expects to lose money for most of 2018.
We hope and pray that the president's doing the right thing. I have confidence in him that he will try to get this figured out soon, and hopefully by Christmas time this year we can be back into able to sell this crop at a profitable level.
But many ag producers are less optimistic. A recent Purdue survey of 400 farmers nationwide saw the largest decline in confidence in the index's history, correlating to the time frame in which the tariffs were enacted. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Samantha Horton.
Days after a grand jury report outlined decades of child abuse within the Roman Catholic Church in Pennsylvania, the bishop of an eastern Indiana diocese promised changes as to how such information is relayed locally. We find out more in this from Rebecca Green.
During a press conference Friday afternoon, Bishop Kevin Rhodes promised to release the names of all individuals credibly accused of abuse within the Diocese of Fort Wayne, South Bend.
If the Pennsylvania grand jury report taught us anything, it's that victims deserve to see the names of their abusers made public for all to see, for everyone to know the pain caused by these priests.
Rhodes says releasing the names is a practice only one in four dioceses within the Catholic Church observe.
It is my hope that by releasing these names, the innocent victims of these horrific and heartbreaking crimes can finally begin the process of healing.
The bishop estimates the release of the names could take at least 2 weeks. Rhodes has served as the bishop of the Diocese of Fort Wayne, South Bend since 2010. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Rebecca Green.
Time once again for Eye on the Arts, and here's John Kane with South Shore Arts.
Joining me for this edition of Eye on the Arts is Kirk Muspratt, music director and conductor of the Northwest Indiana Symphony Orchestra. Kirk, very nice to have a chat with you today.
Yes, our 77th season. I'm very excited, John.
It's about to start. 77 Sunset Strip. Although that has nothing to do with it, I know. But it's my favorite TV detective show. I love that.
I do too.
And this is a really significant season for us because this is the first season, the first full season without the Star Plaza Theater. And it's the first season since 2010 that we won't be performing at Bethel Church anymore. We have all new venues, and we are asking people to follow the music.
Follow the music is our theme, and we hope that they will, because the venues are beautiful and intimate. The acoustics are fantastic. And also, it's just they're easy to get to, and in some ways, it might be even better, really, because you can see the musicians better, you can hear them better, and it's just a more intimate experience. And the halls are great. They're beautiful.
They really are. So the first concert is on September 15th at Monbeck Auditorium, which is at Highland High School. And talk a little bit about our guest artist for that concert.
Yeah, I've worked with them twice before, John. I worked with them once in Utah and once in St. Louis. And they're just a blast. There's six guys who are, if you've been to Mardi Gras and you hear that kind of jazz that's on the street everywhere, they're world famous for it. They're a ton of fun. It's like a Mardi Gras party. I don't know if they'll come marching down the aisle when they come in with the Saints come marching in, but that's what they've done with me in the past. And they kibitz with the audience, and they're just really loose, cool dudes, Dukes of Dixieland.
Right? Yes, or as I like to call them, the Dukes of Disneyland. For some reason, the wrong name keeps coming out of my mouth. I can't control it. I remember hearing the Dukes of Dixieland when I was in college. We had a guest artist series, and that was one of the entertainer groups that came through.
Right, and they probably came just on their own as an extant band, which they do sometimes. Is that right? But we'll have the whole orchestra with them.
Yes. So tell us about the music that will be performed.
Well, they play your typical that style of jazz, which is everything from Fats Domino to Louis Prima, and you know they're for sure going to play When the Saints. But they play everything from honky tonk train blues to What a Wonderful World. South Rampart Street Blues is one. It's a Sleepy Town Down South. Working in a Coal Mine. All variety. Java. So it's real fun. And actually, Tammy's going to get me some beads. Mm-hmm. And I think I'm going to throw some beads very carefully out into the audience.
Oh, yeah. Let's not take out anybody's eyes.
No. It's a hoot. And, you know, something we've talked about amongst us in the office is I hope all the young musicians who are playing in jazz bands in college or in high school will come, you know, and really, because I know the guys, they're very cool. They'll talk to the students after. And it's all, you know, it's very interesting for anybody who's playing in a band at school or playing jazz in the jazz band.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, and they are. I know they are a high energy group, and that'll be fun with it. As you said, when I heard them, they were just a solo group, and it wouldn't have been with a full symphony orchestra behind them.
Right.
So we're going to precede the concert that night with a special subscriber / donor party, a reception that's being hosted by the town of Highland at the Lincoln Center, which is just a short drive away from the high school auditorium, Monbeck Auditorium. And that's going to be from 5:30 to 7, and that is by special invitation to our full subscribers and our donors and our high-level donors, something we do every year. And this is it's a special way to kick off our first concert, our first concert of the season for our 77th season. But we're going to be doing another party that everybody can come to. Last couple of years, we've had a club. We had our 75th anniversary club, our 76th trombones club, and now for our 77th year, we're having our Follow the Music club. So for a $77 contribution, you can be a member of the club and be invited to a party that we'll do at the Lincoln Center in May, prior to our final Pops concert of the season.
Now, John,
yes,
can people give $777 or $7,777, et cetera?
Why, yes, Kirk, they could.
Okay, I just wondered, because in the past we've had seven, you know, like, you know, we did that, you know, so.
Yes.
And some people have been very generous.
Yes, so they have indeed.
It's a great cause.
Okay. Well, come to the concert, Dukes of Dixieland, on September 15th. And, Kirk, thank you for being here to tell us about the concert.
Oh, my pleasure.
And thank you for listening. We'll be back again next week with another edition of Eye on the Arts.
If you miss any part of the conversation, you can go to our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org, and check out the Eye on the Arts conversations. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks for being with us. We have a special Climate One program on the program tomorrow, and back with you on Wednesday.